Welcome to Off
Welcome
the Cut.
To Off the Cut.
Where we talk about building,
a podcast where
making,
we talk about building,
answering
making
all of your questions.
I'm Eric from Spencer Design.
I'm Scott Walsh.
And I'm Zach from Zach Builds. If you have a question that you would like us to answer on air, you can send it to offthecutpodcast@gmail.com.
You can find both.
You can find us
on YouTube
and Instagram.
Unfortunately,
and
because we have people
I don't
kids,
have TikTok.
You can find us on TikTok too.
All right, now let's get into the show.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Off the Cut number 89. We're up here in Toronto, and up here in Toronto, and all the way down in Texas. Today is known as Wednesday, November 8th, 2023. Now, this week, we have a hole in our hearts because Eric is missing. But
what do you mean? Didn't you just hear the intro? I am Eric Spenceley.
No, Eric Spenceley has been kidnapped by the Green Suitors podcast, and thus Scott Walsh is filling in for him, doing his best impersonation of Eric.
Allegedly.
Tune in next week to see if they take your ransom for Eric.
Yeah, it's. I don't have very deep pockets, so if they kill him, they kill
bucks.
Him.
And... yeah, a couple bags of M&Ms left.
Oh, man. Well, so thank you so much, Scott, for joining us and taking, you know, filling the shoes of Eric. I'm sure he appreciates it. He's actually on vacation right now, doing a little bit of scuba diving. So hopefully he's
hasn't drowned
lost
yet.
Underwater. Yeah, exactly. So before we get into the podcast, of course, I got to do the good old fashioned ad read. This is kind of a new thing for the show, but today's podcast is sponsored by none other than KM Tools. That's right. The man who is single-handedly keeping Dapper Dan in business has branched out into the world of retail. So if you don't know who Jonathan Katz-Moses is, he's the man with the best-looking hair in woodworking, and I'm proud to have his store as a sponsor of this podcast. The slogan for KM Tools is, for woodworkers, by woodworkers, and I think that just about says it all. Anything that you can find in their store is either designed and made by Jonathan and his team personally, or it's something that he uses in his shop himself. Seriously, take a look at their inventory. It's all really high quality stuff. And if that wasn't enough, a portion of the profits from KM Tools gets funneled back into the Katz-Moses Woodworkers with Disabilities Fund, which Jonathan uses to outfit disabled woodworkers and builders with new tools, workbenches, and just anything that can make the hobby more accessible to them. So check out kmtools.com, and we might even have some fun bonus perks coming for listeners soon. So stay tuned for that.
Nice. And I have his router plane, not the new one. I have his first edition, and that's already great. So I don't know how he upgraded it. I don't have
the
new one, but I love the old one. I don't use it a whole lot because I don't use router planes a whole lot. But when I have used it, it's been cherry.
See, I have a bunch of Jonathan's tools and I love them all. They, like I said in the ad read, they are all super high quality, but I'm like the, you know, like this video game maker now, and I don't have that much of use for all of these like really cool hand tools, and it sucks because every time I use them, I put my hands on them like, oh damn, this is nice. I just don't get that much of an opportunity to bring them out of storage and use them. So yeah. Like I haven't used this new plane yet, but it looks awesome.
Do you have it?
No, I don't have it.
Oh, okay. Router plane isn't like top of the list in terms of like hand tools, but that one's a good one. So
he offered to send me one. He was like, oh, you should try it out, like that's like the best thing ever. And I was like, it's kind of wasted on me. Like I really appreciated the offer, but yeah. I was like, it's also like a $200 tool, so I was like, I don't know, don't send it to me something that's just gonna accumulate dust.
Yeah, I use a lot more hand tools behind the scenes than people probably think I do. And that's just maybe a content decision. I personally enjoy using a lot of hand tools, and every project that you've seen me make on my YouTube channel definitely has involved a lot more hand tools than you think. Like whenever I glue up a panel, I always scrub it with a plane going across the grain to flatten up the seams. And
so,
then
it
makes sanding so much easier.
So that's interesting. Why? I know you're always very cautious about potentially alienating newcomers to the hobby in your videos. Is that why you do that? You don't want to show hand tools because they might potentially alienate people?
Yeah, I guess. I haven't thought too much about it.
Okay.
But I am not a hand tool channel. And I just find when I watch other channels that try and introduce a bit of hand tool here and there, it just kind of brings down the pace and the momentum of the video for me as a viewer.
Yeah, that's fair.
Not to say that I couldn't do it. And like, I have shown bits and pieces here and there, but it's usually like 1-2 second clip of me using a hand plane and boom, sure. I'm on to the next thing, because to explain what I'm doing will get lost on some people pretty quickly, because I think there is a preconception for a lot of beginner woodworkers that hand tools are hard or maybe elitist or maybe just not relatable at all. So
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong and I should do more of it, but I enjoy doing it when the camera's off.
I think you are right, because I had that same misconception when I started in woodworking, that somehow hand tools were, you know, this other realm of like super high-end woodworking. That's,
well, the prices can be extremely high, but it doesn't have to be. My favorite hand plane was one I paid $50 for. It's a pre-World War II Stanley number 4, and I love the thing to death. And I didn't pay very much money for it. Maybe the prices have risen since I bought it maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But that plane gets used on every single project, and it all comes down to how well you can sharpen, really, because hand tools are infinitely easier when it's sharp, and when it's not sharp, they become a nightmare, and that's why people don't want to use them.
It can get quite laborious to keep your hand tools sharp. Like, that's what's always deterred me from using them a lot of the time, is just the maintenance that goes into it. And 100%. I know it's probably not that bad if you get all set up and you get the right, you know, what do they call it? Like the diamond grit thing. And
We don't have to dive too deep into hand tools right now, because people are already turning off the podcast. True. But I have gone through a journey to simplify my own sharpening setup so I sharpen more, because there was a time when the thought of putting a blade into a jig to sharpen it just turned me off completely. I had the Veritas jig, which is one of the best jigs you can buy, and it makes it super dead easy to get things razor sharp, but I didn't want to do it because it took too much time. So if you think a jig is going to slow you down from sharpening your hand tools, the next easiest way that I have found is to do a hollow grind with a bench grinder or a Tormek style sharpener. So it basically makes this concavity on the face of the cutting edge. And then it's almost like a kickstand for you to sharpen it on a stone freehand.
Sure.
It doesn't want to rock as much.
Yeah.
The problem with freehand sharpening, if you're not really experienced with it, is you can kind of round over the very tip of the blade very easily if you don't have a lot of practice. And I don't have a lot of practice, but when I started doing hollow grind on a bench grinder, it makes it a lot easier to keep that edge sharp without a jig. So it makes it super fast.
I think that's the other thing that kind of makes it hard to talk about hand tools in woodworking videos, is that so much of it is in the feel of the tool, and you have to use it for a while, and it's really hard to put a lot of that stuff to words.
Yeah.
Like how you would sharpen a blade, like hold it, the blade flat on a sharpening stone in order to not round over the nose of it. That's something that you kind of have to feel just by doing it a bunch of times, and it's really hard to put that into words. So I think that kind of makes for boring videos sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing, too, is that hand tools is probably one of the things that you'd want to go in person to a class and get like hands-on instruction from someone who really knows what they're doing. Because like a beginner woodworker isn't even going to know what a sharp hand plane feels like. So they're not going to know when it's right or wrong.
Yeah, good point.
So circling back, this is why it's really hard to make hand tools enticing in a YouTube video. Yeah. Ergo, I don't really talk about hand tools very much in my videos. But I do. Like, I just made 8 drawers, and every single drawer bottom, I went around the rabbet with a shoulder plane to make sure it fit really well. I didn't cover that in the video at all, because it's just like, the shoulder plane's niche already. So
I think that's the unglamorous truth of a lot of YouTube videos, is it looks a lot easier in the video than it is in real life, right? Because if there's any little boring kind of tweaking this way or that way, that's kind of the first stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor when you're doing the edit.
Yeah, and like I just got the rough edit back from my editor, and it's an hour long. And I'm like, oh my God, there's definitely no time for hand tools because there's no time for the rest of everything either. So YouTube is definitely a glass or a rose-colored glasses picture of what the project procedure went like. But like, it has to be entertaining. Otherwise, we can't make money making videos, and therefore we wouldn't make the videos in the first place. So it's never perfect.
When I first started my YouTube journey, I had this idea that I was going to do two versions of every project. I was going to do like the cool one, the one that like, you know, maybe the most people will watch. And then I would also make like a hardcore dedicated one where it's like, here's the measurements. Here's like me not skipping any steps, going way into detail on every point.
But yeah, see, that's the opportunity to make that big, long video, put it behind a paywall and make it into a course.
yeah, true. But it just seems like so much more work than the initial video. Like the kind of like the fun edit, the quick edit, that one I'm into the groove on how to make that. And now have my formula. I don't know how many people would be willing to jump behind the paywall in order to watch like a long form video. So
yeah, that's when it really you need to kind of like figure out your audience and figure out what they're there for. And if you're like someone who's like targeting beginner woodworkers and more education, like Steve Ramsey, woodworking for Mere Mortals, he is the perfect guy to make courses, and he does very well selling his courses.
Yes.
But for someone like yourself, where you're making like kind of entertaining videos, nostalgia, electronics, and video game stuff.
Yeah.
The type of viewer that's going to watch that content probably is not looking to take a deep dive into exactly how you did that. Like, I love FPGAs. Don't get me wrong. I love coding in Verilog. We can get to that later.
Okay. Yes,
but
please.
That's not a course that everyone wants to take. There's probably like three people watching your video who actually would want to learn more about it. So it's a tough sell. It's a lot of work for maybe getting a couple $100.
Exactly. And that's so I've kind of actually been struggling with trying to find products that work well for my audience. So maybe I'm a little bit too close to it. Do you have any ideas off the top of your head about stuff that would work well for my audience?
Like a limited merch run of a project that you think is going to do well. But the thing is that you have to launch it when you launch the video. So you have to be like super like, oh, I know this is going to be a banger. And then you could pay a graphic designer to make like a t-shirt, sell like 200 of them only to create like a rush for it.
Okay. That's interesting.
That's just one idea on the top of my head.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
What's that?
The project
needs a catchphrase.
Yeah, or the project kind of needs a catchphrase. Like, what's the hook of the project?
Yeah.
And that would be the t-shirt. And then you say, I only have 200 of these t-shirts. They're super high quality, and you only have 2 weeks to buy them or whatever. And so get a piece of this project for you.
Interesting.
Sort of thing. Because I think if you posted it for sale, like, oh, you could buy it on my website, people are just gonna be like, oh, yeah, it's cool. I'd like to have that. And then like 3 seconds later, they'd forgotten about it.
Right.
So create that urgency.
Yeah, the urgency. That's the word I'm looking for.
The urgency. Yeah. Yeah. The FOMO, the fear of missing out. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. For a long time, I was really scared to invest the amount of time necessary to create a product, knowing that my only advertising vehicle was going to be a video, and I didn't know whether or not my videos would get a lot of views back in the day. So I really wanted to like not put the cart before the horse. I wanted to be sure that I was relatively sure that I was going to get X number of views per video before investing the time to make products.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like Eric's been doing products since day one. Like, he's been doing plans and all sorts of stuff. So he has this huge back catalog. So I feel like in some ways I'm almost playing catch up, but it's tough to dial in something that works for my audience.
Yeah, your audience is not Eric's audience, and it's not my audience either. And like making plans for sale for you doesn't make sense. And like, so like, don't worry about that at all.
Yeah,
I have started making plans over the past year and a half, and I only have like five, but some of them do pretty well.
Yeah, they sell really well for you, right?
Yeah, fairly well. Yeah, the Workbench video I released 2 months ago or 1 month, when I don't remember what that was, but yeah, that those did pretty well.
Okay. And that was a big video too. That was like 700,000 views or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, and it's still rolling too, so it's nice. Pretty good. So yeah, when
you
can launch
your plans at?
On my website, scottwalsh.co.
Okay. Nice, good plug.
I think I have them on my Etsy store as well, but my Etsy store is like just for, like it was what I used to do, and I haven't updated in a while. Etsy's just weird.
What's what's your back end? Is it all Shopify for your website?
It's all Shopify.
Cool, yeah. Cool.
Shopify is just amazing. I'm not sponsored by them yet. I really want to be.
Do they do sponsorships? They do sponsorships, don't they?
I've seen a handful. They're pretty selective with their clients. So I'm still vying for it because they do longer term contracts too. So
okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's one of those things where they like look at content creators who are crushing it on their platform and then reach out to them for sponsorships.
I don't know. I don't even know how they would make that metric. Like, how would they know that a website is a content creation business?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, there's probably, they probably know. They're pretty smart.
You could probably look and see where the links were coming, where the clicks were coming from that led to the store. And if a bunch of them were coming from YouTube or Instagram or something, they could probably work backwards from there.
Yeah, I have a set of plans being released with the video that's supposed to be released on Saturday that I'm like,
ooh, exciting.
Oh my God, I have so much work to do. And the plans I don't think are done either. So anyway, that video has come along and I built a new miter saw station in my shop.
Well, you were telling me about this.
Yeah, I just finished it yesterday.
Wait. So you finished the build yesterday?
I finished the build yesterday.
And the video is coming out Saturday?
You're making me worried, man.
How? This is like not even, I don't know. In my world, I'm like, I finish a project and then I have like 3 weeks until I launch the video. Like I have like a big gap between.
You have several things going at the same time though, don't you?
Usually I do.
I'm pretty like linear where it's like one thing at a time because that's all my brain can handle.
Yes,
but the sponsor has a deadline of Saturday, plus my family's coming to visit me on Saturday as well. So it's like, if I don't make the deadline, like there's a week where I'm not going to be able to work on it. So I have to get it done.
Okay.
But well, the project turned out amazing. I'm so excited about this.
So walk people through this project. It's pretty cool. You have the miter station on glide rails. Is the saw itself on glide rails?
Yeah. So the saw traverses left and right on the miter saw station. And the point of that is because I have a really small shop and the fact that I put my miter saw on the small wall, not the long wall, I don't really have much room left and right for like the board. So the miter saw station itself is 8 feet long. And if I go put an 8 foot board on it and the miter saw is like right in the middle, bolted down, all I can do is cut that board right in half and that's it. So the idea is, here's a miter saw station where you can cut the board at any point because you can just slide the miter saw over. And it increases the capacity of a small miter saw because I'm not about to put my miter saw where my jointer is on the long wall because my jointer is much more important to me than my miter saw.
Crazy. Fantastic idea.
Yeah.
I got
a huge response on Instagram too. People are like, oh, why didn't I think of that? So I know this video is going to be a banger. So I'm really glad I have a set of plans coming out with it because I got such a good response. So linear guide rails. So basically, or linear guide bearings, which are on rails. So they're very smooth. They just kind of rolls back and forth. And to lock it in place, I have a mag switch. Have you ever heard of a mag switch?
Oh, yeah.
It's like those really heavy magnets that have a knob on it. You turn it and just it locks it in place.
Nice. Do you have an affiliate link for the mag switch?
No, I don't. I mean, I could do Amazon affiliates, but I've heard that mag switch themselves offer probably one of the best affiliate rates.
I think they do. I think it's like 20% or something like that.
I don't know if I have time. I can message Andy Klein maybe.
I have, I don't know, I had a contact there. I have an affiliate link. I haven't used it in years and years now, but I have a contact there. So remind me after we're done on the podcast and I'll forward you that. And hopefully we can get you set up with one real quick.
If they're doing that big of a commission, they must have pretty big margins.
Have you ever, they're
not cheap.
Exactly. I like the Mag Switch stuff. Like, it all works really well. It's expensive. It's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah,
I
remember it was like $80 for the 150-pound one or however much. It was crazy.
Exactly. And I got the adjustable angle gauge one for welding, which is a great tool. I use it all the time. But I think it was like $150 or something like that.
And they have like a drill press fence. It's really cool. But it's like, I don't know, $200 or $300. I don't know how much it is. It was very expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have their featherboard, too, for my table saw, which I use all the time.
I want that. I should get that. I never use my regular featherboard because it's too much of a pain. I don't even know if I'd use it then, but it seems really cool.
I use it all the time. I think it's pretty great.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you should definitely get that. So, okay, so go back to this, to the miter station.
Yeah.
Do you have like a stop block that stays in place, or I guess the one wall would just kind of be your stop block?
It could be. And when I was using it while it was being made, I was actually using the wall as a stop block. But to the left of the saw, I do have like your regular sort of platform that's raised up just as high as the table. And to the right of the saw, I do have a T-track down on the height of the countertop, I guess. So it's really low in comparison to the height of the saw, but I 3D printed a stop block that kind of raises up. It's like a big chunk that raises up at the same height, and it has a kind of a little platform to support the workpiece, and you have an optional thing that lifts up and down to act as a stop block.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm like, it's hard to explain, but if you saw it, you would know exactly what I mean. So it kind of solves a problem of having support where there's no platform to the right of the saw, and it also gives me a stop block.
Yeah, I think I get it, but I'll have to wait till Saturday to see if I truly understand what you're saying. Now, one feature that I think would be really cool to have in something like that is some sort of measurement against the stop block, like either in the guide rail or on maybe on the wall behind it or something like that. Do you have anything like that?
It's tough because where the saw is, it's going to throw the measurement off on the T-track. So it's like, how would you, depending on the saw. So I had a couple of ideas. One, initially, before I even thought of the linear guide rails, before I thought of the mag switch, I was like, maybe I can just have little indentations for it to stop every 10 inches or so. So it would make the math really easy. But then when I thought of the mag switch, I was like, nah, it's got to be the mag switch. So now it's like, it could be, the saw could be anywhere, the stop block could be anywhere. It's kind of difficult. But I did have one thought, and it would have been very complicated. But I'm not shy with complicated, because it involves electronics. But have you ever heard what a DRO is, a digital readout?
No, I don't think so.
So in a machine shop, when you go into like metalworking machines, you have like mills and lathes, and a modern machine shop they all have a DROs outfitted on their machines. So they exactly know where the tool is in reference to the workpiece. And and it's usually down to a thousandth of an inch or even more precise, or in metric or whatever. So I was thinking, if I could have some sort of DRO to the left of the saw and another one to the right of the saw, and then a DRO that would understand where the saw is, and I could do some math, have it all connected to a microcontroller, and theoretically, I could know where the stop block is in reference to the saw blade.
Could you have the DRO on top of the stop block and then reference the blade of the saw?
Well, the DRO would typically reference something stationary. So on a mill, the DROs, there's three per each axis. So like you would have one for the Z height, you would have one for the Y, and you would have one for the X.
And because
it's stationary, it's like, oh, I've moved 1 inch, so therefore let's subtract 1 inch, and that's the distance between the cutter head and the workpiece.
Gotcha. So I'm imagining something more like a laser tape measure almost.
Some sort of optical solution. That's definitely possible. That gets really complicated.
I mean,
so the, there was some references that I found online of people making their own DROs, probably using an Arduino or another microcontroller. Okay. So they, what they would do, I don't have them handy, but they would take regular digital dial calipers, like, you know, a 6-inch pair that you would use to measure small parts and stuff like that. They would
Pair around here somewhere.
Yeah, I have one in the the drawer back there. But they would take those apart and they would print their own circuit board that would be like 500 milliliters long. And they would use the sensor in the dial calipers and
extend
the length of the digital readout. So then I was thinking, well, if I could take an output signal from the caliper, do three of them, so one for the saw, one for the left stop block, and one for the right stop block, stick them all into an Arduino, do some math, and then I would be able to know precisely where the stop block is in reference to the saw blade.
Yeah, yeah. But
that is a lot of work, and that's probably 2 weeks that... 2 weeks of work that I don't want to do for
people.
There's already a hook to the video at this point. Like the hook is I have a miter saw that slides back and forth. Yeah. People are going to click on that. I don't need to do anything else.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. That's an important lesson. Sometimes you have to know when enough kind of gee whiz features is enough and you can stop, you know, working on a video. Like sometimes I'll have like a list of like 10 things that I'd like to put into a project. And I'm like, you know what? 7, 8, and 3 are really time consuming and are not going to generate that many more clicks.
Yeah.
So I'm going to cut them from the project.
Yeah. That was similar to a coffee table that I built a few months ago.
Yeah. The flippy one, right?
The flippy one. So like the whole concept of the coffee table was like, oh, I want to make it a coffee table and an ottoman all in one. The concept of that was probably enough, but then I had to go down this rabbit hole of making it all automated. I don't think it was that important to automate it in the end. That caused me a lot of work and I did it. And it didn't work out 100% correctly, but I probably would have been fine if I'd just been like, oh, my coffee table is an ottoman. Or the fact that I made a pretty nice looking piece of furniture might have been enough in the end as well. So
Yeah. I mean, sometimes just a really good looking picture of the final product in the thumbnail is enough to sell it.
I'm not confident enough as a furniture designer to know when that's going to work. I'm not Nick Padula, but I'm really happy with the design of that coffee table. I think it's definitely my best woodworking I've ever done.
Yeah, it looks great. I really liked it.
But like, I'm not known to be the furniture designer on YouTube. And so therefore YouTube is not going to necessarily point me to that audience.
And do you ever think about, would you ever limit the level of your woodworking? Coming back to that conversation before of not potentially wanting to alienate people, you're trying to target this beginner audience. So would you ever be like, ooh, that's almost like this design is too pretty. I should scale it back a little bit to make it more accessible.
Typically I do. The exception being the coffee table. I just had this moment of like, I want to make this coffee table for my house and I wanted to make it the way I want to make it and not worry about what YouTube thinks, because typically I do make things simpler, A, so I can attach a set of plans to it and sell it and make it easy for people to build, but B, also just make the video itself more accessible as well.
Yeah.
That coffee table video is not accessible at all. It's just watch me try hard stuff. And in a way that style of video is rather selfish because I'm not thinking about the audience. I'm just thinking about what I want. And usually I don't do that, but I just had this moment of like, I want this, I'm doing it.
I mean, sometimes you have to do it for your own sanity. Just do something just for you.
And I'd love to do more.
Yeah. With that video, did you do a set of plans?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
There's no framework for that video to make it easy because the top itself is one big slab. So that in itself is specialized sort of work to be able to deal with that.
Yeah. Right?
So, and then there's the carving on the aprons and that's all like, I can't claim to be able to teach that kind of stuff. Cause half of this, I was just figuring out how's that was going.
Fair enough. I mean, there is a middle road that you could take where you kind of do the special one for you. And then you say, but here's a much more simplified version that I've made a set of plans for.
But like, that's the thing. It's like, here's this cool version. Here's a crappier version for you. Like, that's a pretty hard sell.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plans is tricky.
Well, all of my plans are shop furniture for one. I don't think, I can't claim this, but maybe I will. It's like, I don't think I'm ever going to make plans for something that's not shop furniture.
Well, it would have to be so broad in its appeal.
Yeah, which is tough because furniture for interiors is so subjective with style. And honestly, yeah. If I were, I'd probably do something like all farmhouse furniture or something like that. I know it's like kind of out of style, but at the same time, I think the demo that still likes farmhouse furniture would be the demo most likely to be like, oh, I like that sort of X-brace coffee table sort of thing.
Yeah.
The farmhouse is very approachable from a DIY standpoint as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's a style that lends itself to simple shapes and, you know, a lot of it's made with just like 2x4 construction material or whatever. So.
And it's why Anna White was so successful back in the day. Like it was all farmhouse stuff. It was all super accessible. And I think a lot of her plans were free or very low priced too. So many people did the Anna White plans. So it works.
But I think you hit on a good point. Like it's so subjective that you're almost immediately alienating 99.9% of people. Cause somebody might be like, oh, you know, like it's a nice coffee table, but I don't necessarily, it doesn't match my couch or it doesn't match my, all my other furniture and stuff like that. Where shop furniture is much more functional. People don't really care about the aesthetics. It's what it can do and what it can add to their space.
Yeah, and some of my shop furniture plans that I offer, like my first workbench, my bigger one, and now the miter saw station, there is a little bit of flair to it. With the workbench, the frame and panel drawer fronts is an example. Like you obviously don't have to put frame and panel drawer fronts on a shop furniture, but to me, it's a skill that's definitely worth working on as someone who's a beginner to intermediate woodworker, because it's not so straightforward as just slapping a panel on there. And same thing with this miter saw station. Again, it has frame and panel drawer fronts because aesthetically it looks cool, but it's a skill that you can take to other builds as well.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Do you ever get messages and emails and stuff like that from people sending you completed versions of your plans?
Occasionally, a lot of the workbench ones that sold for my first workbench, I did get a lot of that. My crosscut sled plans, both of them sold very well. I haven't seen one. Like,
really?
Yeah. I've sold hundreds of them. And in one of the first page of the plans, it says, like, show me a picture, send it to my Instagram at Scotty D. Walsh. No one has ever sent me a photo of the crosscut sleds before. I don't know if people are making them or not. But they still sell well.
Well, I mean, if the plans are selling, I guess that's the most important thing. But I always love it when people send me like photos of like, hey, I made a coffee table in your style, or, you know, like, hey, I did this thing inspired by your work. It's always really satisfying to get those.
Yeah. Yeah. Our mutual friend Arpad made my workbench.
Oh, nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in the middle of like redoing his whole shop now. Like that kid, he's really, for everybody listening, they should check out his channel. He's a really impressive woodworker. He's 16, maybe
he's probably
15?
Like 17 or 18 by now.
Okay. Built his own workshop from the ground up, like
framing, you know, and everything.
Yeah, framing and everything. And then recently just abandoned it and is now moving into a new space that he's currently outfitting.
Yeah, so that's such a me move too, just to spend so much time and effort and money on building something, and then like 3 months later I'm like, okay, bye. I don't care. That's like, and people are like, but you put so much effort into it. Like, I don't care. It's, you know, building on the next thing is more fun than like, you know, thinking about
coveting the last.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I get that from the point of view of like furniture and stuff like that in my house. Like I'll make coffee table after coffee table after coffee table and just keep throwing the old ones out or giving them away to friends, because I'm more concerned with the act of building it than I am actually enjoying the finished product. It doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah, that's a great question that I often ask different people is like, do you enjoy the process more? Do you enjoy the designing more? Do you enjoy the final result more? And the answer always is different for each person. And I think it's not like a black and white thing. We each enjoy a certain amount of each. And for me,
for sure,
I think I almost enjoy like the design and the results kind of equally as much. And sometimes like the process isn't as fun for me. Like I almost like the designing and like having the finished piece done. I think it depends on the project though.
I like the concepting more than anything. Like, not even getting into the nuts and bolts of designing, but just being like, wouldn't it be neat if I did X?
Yeah.
And then that's my favorite part right there. And then everything else after there is like just kind of obligatory.
Ideation.
I like whenever you plan out the design and you get to the final step and you've done it and they look exactly the same. That right there is the payoff for me.
Okay. Yeah.
And like, since I've been, I've always modeled my stuff in SketchUp, but I think now I'm at a point where if I model something in SketchUp, I know it's going to turn out well in the end. I think for a lot of people, it's kind of a mental block where it's like, oh, I see it on the screen or even I see it on paper, but I don't see it as a completed piece of furniture. But I just think if you do it enough, I've been using SketchUp since like the early 2000s when it came out. And once you do it enough, it becomes like second nature when you draw something in 3D and it'll turn out the same. That whole coffee table that I made was all drawn in SketchUp. Even like all really? The facets and everything was all drawn in SketchUp. And I was like, okay, I'm confident that it's going to turn out cool. And I went and made it and it turned out cool.
I get so frustrated with SketchUp trying to do like the simplest things. Like Eric and I have a joke that as soon as you make a curved line in SketchUp, it's just permanent. Like it's there forever. And you can't alter it in any way. So I don't know. Maybe you're more sophisticated with it and you're better at using it. But I've transitioned over to using Fusion 360 now, and I much prefer that.
And I've heard that a lot. And I've tried to learn Fusion 360 three times. And I like to think I'm a pretty flexible person, but I cannot wrap my head around it because SketchUp and Fusion 360 are just like opposite ends of the spectrum.
It's like SketchUp.
SketchUp's kind of like Microsoft Paint. And like Fusion 360 is like Adobe Illustrator. Like it's with SketchUp, you're like, it's like pixel by pixel sort of things.
Right. But
I don't know. I've been using it for so long. It's probably nearly 20 years I've been using it. I cannot like do anything else. It's nuts. But there are a lot of tips and tricks that I've found out, but there's a lot of quirks and quirks that you got to kind of like know about and, SketchUp's good with plugins. Like there's a lot of extensions to do things to make it easier, like doing chamfers and roundovers and things like that.
Interesting. Yeah, now that I've taken the time to learn Fusion, I don't think I could ever go back to SketchUp. And I only use like, you know, the bottom 10% of the capabilities of Fusion. But for woodworking projects, like that's all you need. Even 3D printing projects.
Yeah, and for most people, I think SketchUp is probably a lower barrier of entry in terms of like knowledge and stuff like that. It's pretty easy just to bang out a cube or a box or anything really quickly in SketchUp. And for very basic furniture making, doing cabinetry or whatever, as long as there's no intense compound curves, SketchUp can easily do that.
Yeah.
But I would love to learn Fusion to the capacity that I know SketchUp, but I don't have a lot of time to do that. And I probably need a good course to teach me how. And
The one Eric and I always recommend to everybody is it's a YouTube course. It's all free. It's called Learn Fusion 360 in 30 Days. And honestly, I did the first 5 or 6 days of that course. And that was sufficient for any woodworking project, I think. So, and they're like 15 minutes each. So honestly, you could learn it in the span of an afternoon if you wanted to.
Yeah, I probably just dove into it without instruction, and I keep trying to revert to SketchUp mentality, where like with SketchUp, you have your measuring tape, and you can stick a guide point anywhere or a guideline anywhere. But with Fusion 360, I'm like, I just want to measure from here to here or something like that, and like, I can't figure it out.
You can do it. It's just you use the I key instead of the T key.
Whatever. that's a future Scott problem if I ever get into Fusion.
Yeah, fair enough.
My plans guy uses Fusion, so I should probably switch to that for him, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah. So how do you go back and forth between the two?
I don't know. Ask him. I send him the SketchUp file.
And he just figures it out?
And he deals with it. I'm like, great. Thank you.
I guess there's some plugin to like translate between the two, probably.
Or I don't know if he exports an STL or I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, so for all your 3D printing projects, do you use SketchUp?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Sorry, guys. My headphones just died. So you're probably going to get some feedback from me.
Oh, I hear a good delay from me.
Yeah.
like a good Van Halen solo. I don't hear it anymore. Yeah, so I'll just talk anyway. So, 3D printing and SketchUp usually don't go hand in hand. A lot of people who are into 3D printing do use Fusion, and I get it.
Yeah.
But because I just can't friggin' figure out Fusion, I've just stuck with SketchUp. And honestly, it works just fine. Sometimes I have some issues with some geometry that doesn't always transfer over to the slicer program. But the Bamboo Lab slicer program is pretty smart, and it can make up for SketchUp's deficiencies. Yeah. So yeah. You can use SketchUp for 3D printing.
Okay. So what do you do?
The chisel thing you did was pretty good.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well. And like most things work out pretty well, honestly.
So can you export as an STL from SketchUp?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, okay. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, and yeah, like, so, as far as I know, like when I look at like the quality of the physical print, there's not really much difference, because like there's, when you do curves in SketchUp, like they, you know, it cuts it into individual lines, but you can adjust how fine the resolution of those lines are.
Oh, wait, it does it in SketchUp? Because in my mind, that's the job of the slicer.
In terms of like layers, that is a slicer. But I mean, like when you make a curve and the resolution's low, it looks like just like a.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I've never actually zoomed in enough on. I mean, I guess at some level, even my Fusion 360 files must have that going on at some level.
I think they do as well. It's just in SketchUp that it defaults to a pretty low curve resolution. So you always see like it looks like a loony. Sorry for the American viewers.
Yeah, no. That's a reference looks I a understand loony. Perfectly clearly.
Yeah.
What's that, Derek?
I said it just looks a little loony.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So what's going on in Zach Build's land in terms of upcoming projects?
Well, I just finished a set of speakers. So I think we talked about this. Scott and I had dinner the other night, and we're kind of just geeking out about various things on YouTube. But I was telling you about this, the DIY Dolby Atmos height speakers that I made.
Yeah.
So I just spent all of today recording all the voiceovers for that project. So that's now with my editor. But I've been going pretty gung-ho. My Nintendo 64 video is doing really well.
Nice.
So I've went out on the Canadian version of Craigslist, Kijiji. And I was like, okay, the Nintendo 64, very popular system. I think a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for that. I was like, what's another system that in a similar vein? And I was like, well, what's the best-selling console of all time? And it's the PlayStation 2. So
I went
out and bought a PlayStation 2 off of Kijiji, which is our Canadian Craigslist, and I've been slowly trying to make a chassis for it out of 3D printing. It's not focusing very well.
Yeah, it's not focusing.
I don't want to give too much of it away anyways. But this is far and away my most ambitious 3D printing project.
Ah, cool.
Because I'm trying to use all the original mounting points for the hardware. And it's just a pretty complex shape, and it's got a lot more moving parts than a Nintendo 64. So
yeah. Oh man, I played so much Metal Gear Solid back in the day with PS2. I miss those days.
So I've actually, it's really annoying that I've just kind of figured out the final dimensions of the case that I'm going to make for it. And it's like 2 millimeters too big to print on my Bamboo Labs carbon. So I'm going to have to use the K1 Max.
Right.
Because it's a little bit bigger.
I have the K1 Max and it's still in the box.
You haven't taken it out of the box still?
No, there is a corner which you can't see in my office where I know it's going to live, but I need to like get a table for it because otherwise I'm not going to be able to reach it.
I had mine on the floor for the longest time.
Actually, my P1P is right here. I don't know if you can see it. It's black, so you can't really see it.
I think I can see the corner of it there. Yeah.
So I use my P1P for everything. I know you like the X1 Carbon. These are both Bamboo Labs printers.
Yes.
But honestly, if you're just doing basic 3D printing, the P1P does everything you want.
Yeah, my only concern... So the P1P, for people at home who don't know, is it's essentially the same printer as the X1 Carbon, but they've stripped out some of the kind of nice-to-have features of it, right? Like, for instance, my printers are fully enclosed, whereas yours is like an open frame, right?
I made an enclosure for, and this was before they released their version of the P1P that comes with an enclosure.
Yeah, that's the P1S, right?
Okay, yeah.
So that was a confusing move to me, because the P1S is like a hop, skip, and a jump from the X1 Carbon. Like, there's really not that much of a difference between them.
Price-wise, I thought, I don't know what the price is difference. I thought it was like $500 more.
No, the price is significantly different, but the difference in features between the two of them is not that much, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, like, there's certain filaments that it probably can't do, but like for most basic stuff, like I'm not printing with anything crazy like the carbon fiber ones or anything like that. Like, those filaments are too expensive for this cheapo. So, like, I'm just doing, like, you know, price. PLA and PETG and TPU, like the basic ones, and it does everything that I need to do. And if they had the P1S, I would have got that over the P1P, because, like, I don't want to make an enclosure. For those wondering, an enclosed 3D printer does better if you're printing PETG, which is a bit of a stronger filament. Otherwise, it can just, like, come off the base plate.
Yeah, so when you have a 3D printer that's fully enclosed like that, it's easier for it to regulate the whole temperature of the enclosure. Whereas with an open bench one, you're only able to regulate the temperature of the bed. And so there can be distortions that happen, you know, throughout the print that are easier to, I don't know, it's a more controlled environment.
Yeah.
And I've heard with some filaments, you can actually, like, if there was a breeze in your room, it can actually affect the plastic as it's coming out of the nozzle and lead to poor adhesion or artifacts in printing and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, so, that's our 3D printing tangent. But yeah, back to your PS2.
Yeah, so I've designed it. It's like I did everything I could to chop out every little millimeter and make it as small as possible. But just the base components of it are size such that I'm going to have to go away from my beloved X1 Carbon and use the K1 Max. K1 Max is like 20% bigger, I think. And it'll be my first time really using it. I've used it for small stuff, but I've never used it for a complete project before. So I just went online and bought a bunch of accessories for it. So I'll give it a nice shakedown in this project. It'll be fun.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. So besides 3D printing, what else? Are you doing any sweet upgrades to the PS2?
Oh, yeah. Sure. So the first thing I did was rip out the CD drive, and I replaced it with a 1 terabyte solid state drive. So I'll be able to have, like, basically every game. Everything. Well, not every game. The PS2's got a big catalog, but I'll be able to play everything that I want off just the hard drive. I'm going to do an HDMI mod to it. I'm going to power it with USB-C. I upgraded the cooling.
Nice. As long as you can play Solid Snake, like, that's
exactly
all.
Exactly. I'm gonna be able to play Solid Snake in, I think, 1080p or maybe even 1440p with this HDMI mod that I got. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It, like, steals the signal as it comes off of the GPU and then sends it to this upscaling unit that then pipes it out of HDMI.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun.
I saw you did
that
with the
made up of polygons.
Yeah.
You are still limited by the polygons. It's true, but it'll be at least less jaggy, or it'll have less aliasing than it would.
Yeah.
Otherwise.
I saw you did that with the N64, and that was pretty sweet.
Yeah. So very similar process, but this is a much higher end HDMI mod, so it's much better at upscaling the image. And the PlayStation lends itself to upscaling a lot better than the Nintendo 64 does too.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm hoping it does well. I've been looking. One trick that I learned from you, Scott, is kind of going on YouTube and researching whether or not videos on that topic get a lot of clicks.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of very low quality videos getting a lot of views on this topic. So I'm hopeful that it'll do well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I look forward to seeing it. PlayStation 2 might have been my favorite console growing up.
See, this is so I'm a weirdo in that I never had one. I had friends who had them, but I was an idiot and I bet all my money on the Sega Dreamcast taking off when I was like, you know, 10 years old or whatever.
I remember seeing, like, this display at whatever store I was in, like whatever game store. It was like the Sega Dreamcast, and I was like, whoa, like, that's sick. But, you know, we ended up with the PlayStation. I was the young child, so it wasn't my decision.
Well, I mean, you made the right choice because the Dreamcast died a very unceremonious death, and the PlayStation 2 lived on for a long time. So I was like, oh, I should do the Dreamcast because I have so much of my own like emotions tied up in it. But then I was like, oh, no, okay, wait. After looking on YouTube, there's much more interest in PS2, so I'm going to do the PS2. Mm-hmm.
Nice. So I've asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again for the benefit of the listeners. You do a lot of like electronics content. Are you going to get into anything like microcontrollers, aka Arduinos?
I did an Arduino project recently, which was my air quality meter. I'm actually still working on editing the video for that. But it's an air quality meter that's powered by an Arduino. That being said, I used somebody else's code and their designs in order to do it. So it kind of got my feet wet with the process, but I now know from doing that that there is a lot of like base level learning that I have to do in order to support it. And it's kind of like, oh, do I want to invest all this time into it?
Like me and Fusion.
Exactly, right? So if I had the right project in mind where I was like, oh, this is, I think this is going to do really well and that'll justify me learning it, then I will. But until I find that perfect project, I don't know that I will.
Yeah. I don't think it's as much of like a Mount Everest as you think it is. There's like a handful of basic coding concepts for coding in C with Arduinos that you'll need to know. And these are coding concepts that are like very basic with all coding languages at that sort of level of coding. So, you know, very basic things like if statements, loops, how to create variables and things like that. You can do so much. One of my older projects, the that video didn't do really well on my channel a long time ago. I automated my dust collection system.
Oh, and that's cool.
So basically every single machine had a little sensor that I made that sent a signal to an Arduino that would tell the Arduino if the machine had turned on. And then I made all these custom blast gates where the blast gate itself was attached to a servo motor. So that would open and close the blast gate. And each dust collector, because I had two dust collectors, had a relay on it to turn on and off the dust collector. So basically, whenever I'd touch a machine on, it would send a signal to the Arduino that was like, oh, open the blast gate for that machine and turn on that dust collector for that machine.
Yeah.
The coding ended up being kind of long, but it was all just a bunch of basic if statements and things like that. Sure. I think I had made some functions, but like beyond making functions, it's all pretty straightforward stuff. So you can do a lot with not a whole lot of coding.
Yeah. Okay. Something like that. I think I could probably wrap my head around. I do have a little bit of background in like Python and JavaScript and stuff like that. So I am familiar with some of the basics. I would still have to obviously learn the ins and outs of the Arduino language.
Yeah.
But,
so Arduino is C.
Is it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it had its own language.
It has its own libraries, but you can, it is C and you can basically do anything you can with C. So language C is a very basic language, but I don't mean basic as in like it's a bad thing. It's it's in a way it can be more advanced because you need to kind of write more code to do less over something like Python or Java, which are more fleshed out languages that have a lot of built-in functionality. The thing with Python is that there's probably a function already made within it, and you just got to Google a function to figure out what it is. Whereas there are libraries, but it's not a lot. And so you might need to write your own functions or do stuff like that. So the good thing about Python, it kind of seems more beginner friendly because it's more searchable in a way. Like it's almost like there's more resources. But Arduinos are not powerful enough to run Python. But
interesting.
As far as I know, because I think Arduinos are 8-bit and Python can only run a 16-bit, something like that. I'm not super knowledgeable about that. But Raspberry Pis can run Python. Now, Python isn't as an efficient language as C is, but for doing basic stuff, it really doesn't matter. So if you are knowledgeable in Python already, or you're looking to get into it without a lot of like low-level language knowledge, then maybe grab a Raspberry Pi. They're a bit more expensive than Arduinos. But grab a Raspberry Pi. You can use Python Or you can do C on a Raspberry Pi as well if you want to. But grab a Raspberry Pi and you can do a lot with that. And Raspberry Pis are much faster than an Arduino.
Yeah. I was actually looking at getting the new Raspberry Pi 5 that just came out and using it for like a, you know, for a game console video. But I don't know. Maybe I could find another use for it. It's honestly, like I said, it's just a matter of finding the right project that excites me.
I find that since learning all this over the years, I can't stop thinking of projects that I want to do with it, because it's like at the end of the day, an Arduino is a microcontroller, and all a microcontroller is a bunch of inputs and outputs and some code that just has instructions for what to do with those inputs and outputs. Mm-hmm. So that's all it is in essence. Yeah. Like you can connect anything you want that's at the right voltage and stuff to, and there's already a bunch of little components you can buy out there. So like I just made an MP3 player for my buddy John Cesaro of Lincoln Street Woodworks. If you caught a recent video of his, he made this musical bar cart, and I made the musical part him.
You were telling me about that.
Yeah. So like all it was a bunch of limit switches so that when he lifted off a bottle of gin, the limit switch would turn off. It sent a signal to the Arduino that said, play Gin and Juice.
Right.
The song to this. Yeah. And I just connected an amplifier from an output of the Arduino. And that amplifier is connected to a speaker. And again, it's like inputs and outputs and a code that tells it what to do with those inputs and outputs when something changes. So once you like kind of have that sort of knowledge, like anything's possible. And in my back of my mind, I have so many ideas for projects, like so many. And I'm not going to be able to do a quarter of them. And most of them aren't good for YouTube either. But if one, it's kind of one of those things where when you learn it, you get really inspired.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is listening to this, or maybe even just for my own edification, would you suggest that somebody invest the time to learn Arduino? Or would you just say skip the middleman and go straight to Raspberry Pi and do it in Python?
It's a good question. I think if you're the type of person who is a bit more frugal, and B, doesn't mind getting into the nitty gritty, learn C, and then the world is your oyster, basically. You can do anything you want. With Python, it is a little bit easier. The syntax is a bit easier and it's more forgiving. What I mean by syntax, sorry, is let's just say the punctuation of the language, let's say. Python's more forgiving in that regard. There's a lot more functions that are already out there, so it's a bit easier and maybe faster to code. But with C, you can do exactly what you want. So if you're more like, let's say you're more like type A or whatever, do the C, do Arduino. If you're more frugal, do C, do Arduino. If you don't mind spending a bit more for a Raspberry Pi, and maybe time is a factor, maybe do Python and Raspberry Pi.
Gotcha. Yeah, one of the limitations I ran into working on this air quality meter that's powered by an Arduino is that it was just super slow to respond to stimulus, like, you know, changes in the environment. I, you know, sprayed a little bit of spray paint, and there'd be like, a 10 to 30 second delay between when I could smell it personally and when the machine started picking it up. And I can even see, you know, you press a button on the screen to open up a menu or something like that, and it would take 5 seconds for it to happen.
So Arduinos are slow for certain things. I have a feeling with it, it probably could detect the input as fast as possible. It might be the
outputting it to the screen.
The screen might be a slow thing because like displays like that do take a lot of instructions to happen. And Arduinos, they're very fast to do most things that are everyday, but when it comes to displays and things that might seem more modern technology, it would struggle with, and a Raspberry Pi is probably faster at that. And if you have the code for the Arduino in C, then you should be able to plant that in a Raspberry Pi, and it should work a bit faster.
Well, I was using a lot of libraries that I think were designed for the Arduino. Would I be able to then port those over to the Pi?
I think so. Yeah, not very experienced with using Pis,
fair enough.
The library is not Arduino. The library is C. And you can flash C to machine language to go on a Raspberry Pi the same way.
Okay.
But again, I don't have a ton of experience with that, so that's just my high level understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, Oh, go ahead, Derek.
Oh no, I was just gonna ask. So the Arduinos, am I wrong? Are they physically smaller than the Pis come typically are?
Hold on. I think I got one here.
There's a couple of different ones from the company Arduino. Nano. So that's one of the smaller ones you can get.
This is a Pro Mini.
Pro Mini. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Basically, there's a few different chips that Arduinos use. And then there's a few different formats in terms of size the board is. So you have options, but there's some small Raspberry Pis as well. And there's other microcontrollers and there's other CPUs as well. Another popular one that's coming up a lot recently is the ESP32. It's a very fast, I think it's a CPU. It's not a microcontroller. I can't remember.
I use that to power a set of LED lights or control a set of LED lights. And it was actually really easy to use. But then again, I was still just using somebody else's code. You know, like I flashed operating system onto it that was designed to control LEDs.
Yeah.
So I wasn't making anything from the ground up in that sense. I was just kind of using other people's work.
Coding is interesting in the fact that when I do a project and I start with someone else's code, I get very confused very easily.
Yeah.
It works better when you just start from the ground up so you know exactly what everything is. Because when you look at someone else's variables, it all gets very confusing. When you do it all yourself, it's like, okay, I can diagnose anything in my own code now. I know exactly
why I named it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even with code that's like properly commented, it's sometimes really hard to still wrap your head around various functions and variables and why they're named the way they are and what they do.
And I'm terrible at making comments on my own code, like brutal. But at least if I've written it, like I know what I meant.
I mean, I don't think I've ever... The few coding projects that I have done, I don't think I've ever commented them because I'm like, realistically, I'm the only person who's ever going to look at these.
Yeah. And so I guess in general with electronics, like making your own stuff with Arduino or Pi or whatever you're using, you don't. And as a tangent, you don't have to use Arduino or Pi. You can buy the microcontroller that's on those boards by themselves. And
oh, really?
Yeah. So there's the one that's commonly on the smaller Arduinos is like the AT328 or something like that. Like
that sounds familiar.
You can buy those chips separately, but the process of flashing the code onto the chip becomes a little more complicated. I've used a microcontroller called the PIC, and they make a lot of different sizes and bits and different program storage on them as well. And it's not so straightforward. You need a device to plug it in. You put it on a breadboard and you connect some pins to a USB dongle and it's all a bit complicated, but it's kind of cool. Actually, that Nixie clock that's right there, that has a PIC microcontroller in it. So,
cool.
So you don't have to do the Arduino if you're more of a do-it-yourselfer, but it does make it a heck of a lot easier. So in general, if you are interested in electronics, Arduinos and stuff are super fun. You probably just need to kind of get a few other general electronics concepts under your belt as well. What's voltage, what's current, just general stuff like that to make sure you know what devices are compatible, because you can't like stick a device that requires 12 volts to turn on and try and power it with an Arduino, because an Arduino can only handle 5 volts. So
that's actually something that I've been learning a lot of through modding the consoles, because I've been replacing the power supplies on them. Like the Nintendo 64, I used a USB-C power delivery standard to supply voltage to it. But the Nintendo 64 needs a couple of different voltages. So I had to call for 12 volts, send 12 volts to the machine, but then take a secondary line, step it down to 3.3 volts, and then send it to the motherboard. So I was getting my feet wet with that a little bit, and knowing about amperage and, you know, not making sure you can pull enough amps in order to power things. So, yeah.
I am not the type of person to correct people's grammar, because, you know, I'm the first person that people correct in terms of grammar. But whenever someone says amperage, I just die a little inside.
Okay. Current. Sorry.
I'm sorry to be that person, but
it's okay.
That's the one word I correct people on, and that's my only thing that I do.
Derek is flashing the after show lights at me. So I think we've run over an hour now. So what do you say we head over to the after show?
Yeah. What's in the after show?
Another 30 minutes of this.
Hell yeah.
Except it's behind a pay gate for our patrons.
Hell yeah.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. And, you know, I think in this episode, we proved that we can do the podcast without Eric.
Who? So,
yeah, who? Yeah. So maybe I'll send him a pink slip.
Oh, well, thanks for having me as a guest host.
Yeah, no, seriously. Thank you for coming in and filling the shoes and, yeah, sharing knowledge with the people. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks for stopping by.
Have a good night.
All right, everybody. See you next week.